Okay, we can begin. Yeah, we can begin. Today is Monday, nice morning, although they said rain. So far it only rained when I got out of the car and had to walk from the parking lot to enter Gris. March 21st, 2016. I apologize for not saying hello to all my students last night. It dawned upon me afterwards. I didn't mention all those listening across the world, but Sunday I have a bigger crowd than Monday, so I was preoccupied with all those sitting in front of me. I have a lot to say and what to fill in with our lectures over the months. First of all, I have to tell you, I personally was very happy to see. I have a piece in the Rav where I quote Rebbe, where the Rav quotes his great grandfather, Rabbi Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, where Rabbi Yosef Dov said that you come up with a good svara and you see others are saying the same thing, you know you're on the proper track. So I have to tell you, a week ago in the Friday edition of Makori Shon, there were two articles that made me very happy. One, a review of my Talmud, Professor Adam Furziger, evidently came out with a book on American Orthodoxy, and I don't know if he cites me or he made the point on his own, but I'm happy to see my Talmud, who's in research. I'm talking off the cuff, theories. That I hit the nail on the head, that even today, Lakewood is involved in outreach, how Chabad set an example which everyone mimics, and the difference being what I said in class, that the Lakewood outreach is a Lakewood style. It comes through Kolalim, and the Chabad is Chabad, it's a world unto itself, but even Lakewood, what I learned in Lakewood, could you imagine if they told Reb Aaron Kotler, Ein seide vet me machen mit de kehilim, vet ze letin in reishe stas. Rabbi would have gone through the ceiling. That's what you're wasting. Everyone understand Yiddish? I lost it. Danny, you have all that Yichistani, and you don't know Yiddish? Wow, okay, we'll say it in English if I can. It's very hard for me, because I'm living it as I lived it. That imagine if they would go to Rabbi Kotler and say, we're going to make one Seder with the Balabatim and teach them Reshit Dat. You know what Reshit Dat is? That's the volume when I learned Alephbet, when Morty learned Alephbet. Charlie, did you? When the three of us learned Alephbet, we have long white beards. Look at us. And Ba-Ga, you understand how to read Hebrew. So Reb Aaron would have flipped his lid. That's what you're wasting your time on, the way they constantly critique Lubavitch. I mean, they're standing on the street corners, giving out the Jason, giving out the Lulav and Etrog, and today Lakewood. And he makes the point why you missed the boat. That YU was asked to open a center in Chicago. This is true, I think in the 70s, and they couldn't handle it. See, YU has gone through a very bad period following Reb Shmuel Belkin. The first part of his presidency was fabulous, but in 69 there was a stock market crash, and YU had tsaros. In the 70s, only because a few dopes living in Israel named Lenny Rosenfeld and a guy named Aaron Rakefet, we pulled off shtick that forced YU to open this. We forced them because they were not interested. But when I got the building from Mr. Gris, YU had a tremendous dilemma. Do you slap Mr. Gris's face? He's only worth billions of dollars. Or do you go along with him? Let those morons in Israel have a little branch. But they couldn't handle it. There was no money. They had problems in New York. When Rabbi Lamb came in, the yeshiva was practically foreclosed. There are endless stories how they had a meeting with the top board of trustees, and in a separate room, the Rav was sitting there and learning. Then they, when Rabbi Lamb had made his presentation, they knocked on the door, the Rav came out, and you know, the Balabatim can say yes or no to Rabbi Lamb. Very hard, as you heard yesterday, Shia, to say no to the Rav. And that saved the yeshiva. There was Sheldon Sokol. He put the package together with the bank, with Joe DiMaggio's bank. You don't know what went on. And in the 70s, so why you didn't open in Chicago, who knows the Chicago community? Lakewood has a tremendous kollel there. Tells built a fabulous branch. Had YU gone to Chicago and they were already in Los Angeles and they gave that up afterwards, it would have been a different picture. But today, even YU is branching out with some kollelim. But when you come into a community like Lakewood or Toronto, you're a Johnny-come-lately. they already conquered the community. So I was very moved by that. Also, there was a tremendous article in that Macari Shon that echoed my very words in class, that this Israeli all hepped up. He's gone to America on Shlichut, and he's furious at the American Orthodox Jews that they don't come in Aliyah, and he wants to slit their throats. And he recognizes not everyone is going to come in Aliyah, not everyone is on that level, not everyone has that ability. There are a million and one problems. This one has aged parents, this one can't speak Hebrew, doesn't have ability with language, he's frightened, this one has a career in American Jewish American sociology, what's he going to do in it? But he recognizes you've got to keep the communities in the Gola strong. The more communities you have, the more Jews you have. And the more Jews you have, the finer the Aliyah that you have. So I was happy to see word by word what I said in class. I'm chayshish that people are listening to me. You know, I can tell you, a whole country came out by Rabbi Shlomo Abiner. On the Rav's volume on communal problems, the volume that Torah HaRav put out with the Rav's answers on communal problems, women studying Torah, chaplains, and I'm happy to see time and again he quotes me there, but he's quoting me from my lectures. And so someone is listening, Baruch Hashem, I can't believe it's Rav Aviner, but they tell me he has an assistant who's an American born, and he his English is native. I also want to mention that I had a lot of nachat. One of my dear grandsons, who was in class here a few weeks ago, when he had off between terms. So this past week, his uncle, my son-in-law's brother, he's the controller of Taglit in Israel, of the money, what comes in, what is spent. He's in charge. And a very capable person, had some very big jobs in Israel. Also a graduate of Machon Lev, Larry Ackerman, should live and be well. So Larry says to my grandson, you know, Taglig works, they have to have Israelis. I think for every 10 people, there has to be one Israeli, or every 5, one Israeli madrich with the group to interact with them, to show them what an Israeli is like. And the group is coming in from Mayanot, that's Chabad. And can you take off time from school? Well, it's very limited. It's not like the Kola where you're in Rakefet's class, you walk in, you walk out. No one can believe that's the same Rakefet who in 1960s, if a kid got an 80 on my exam, he called his parents, I got an 80 on the Rebbe's exam. I was like the Rev, I was a tyrant, I was a terror. I'm telling the truth, I'll give you names to check me out. And then I went in Aliyah, the boat took 12 days each day. I lost more and more of my self-centeredness and my ego. By the time I reached Israel, there was next to nothing left, Baruch Hashem. I have never given an exam since the day I came in Aliyah. And believe me, I've never stopped teaching. So he can only cut, I think, 3 classes. So he took off the week. He was with them. He came back. He said to me, wow, I now understand Lubavitch. You know, he's a kid who grew up here. He doesn't know what it's all about, basically. He knows the army, he fought in battle, he was wounded, he buried friends. He said to me, it's a group, not one kid religious. And Chabad picks these boys and girls off the street. And he said, you have no idea how some of their hearts opened. One kid, he asked my grandson, what do you have on your arm, a little bindle? And my grandson explained it's the name of a kid. My grandson's a graduate of Akoltel, and this kid was second year Akoltel, Aviyata Terjim, and Hashem Yikom Damo. And my grandson prepared him for the Gibush Lutzan Chanim. And he said the kid never came back from the war. And he wears it. And he said these kids with no knowledge, they were in tears. He never appreciated what it means to be born in Jerusalem, to live in Jerusalem, to walk the streets of Jerusalem. He said Friday, when the bus came up the hill to Jerusalem, he said it was just overwhelming, the reaction of these youngsters. So you got to give Chabad all the credit in the world. Also, what I said in lectures a while back about recent shluchim to Chutz Laaretz, so they go for 3 years, You can't expect to compete with a Chabadnik who was there for life. And if you think I was making it up, here's an advertisement, Eretz Chemda, which we have a tie-in. One of our faculty here, my student, Rabbi Danny Mann, teaches in Eretz Chemda. Rabbi Kamel, Eretz Chemda, so they have a whole program. 5-year post-smicha fellowship at Eretz Chemda. Very generous stipends. And he gives you the whole limud. Evidently it's in English, because I see everything here is in English. New obligation, when you finish the program, obligation to go on Shlichut and Chutz Laretz for 3 years. Have I made my case? 3 years. No, you're going to take on a Chabadnik who's there already 13 years, 23 years, 30 years. First year till you learn what type of coffee the people like. The second year you function. The third year, what will I do when I get back home to Eretz Yisrael? A very beautiful letter from a Rav who's a Shaluach in Orlando, Florida, Rav Nissen. And again, he proves my point. But here there's sources, 3 different cases that the Rebbe was asked, should I open up in this area? The local rabbi opposes, says we don't need Chabad here, the shul is struggling. And 3 times the Rebbe said, keep away from machloket. I'm quoting the Rebbe, dache shalom. It is severe to cause machloket. In one instance, they didn't mind Chabad moving in, but go to Columbia, but don't make your own minyan. We have trouble getting a minyan every day. It's the Torah world here is not that big. Chabad until today has activities all week, but on their website it says, we do not sponsor our own minyanim. Please pray at the Central Orthodox Synagogue. And that's where the Chabadnik can play. So it builds my thesis that although there's been machloket and contention, humans are humans, but the Rebbe, if you ask him, we run away from machloket. A guy named Yomo did the research on a word I learned from the Rav, willy-nilly, and it's very fascinating. It should really be nilly-willy. You'll read it. But willy-nilly, and what it means, al apo v'chamoto ya'aneh amen, in a rabbinic aphorism. Also, I want to make this is actually a correction. I didn't recall the story in entirety. I thank Rabbi Yeshua Grinstein, my dear student, that famous episode, I don't know if I told it in the Sunday class, the Monday class, but I just want to make the correction publicly. It's not a major correction, but still, Scott, you have to have intellectual honesty. You know that. A Talmud of the Rav, you know my what. I think the Rav considered it worse if you didn't have intellectual honesty than if you wait in Yom Kippur. So a Talmud of the Rav has to be very careful. Rav Yehuda Mital meets this guy in Israel, and the guy is, they knew each other from the old country, from Hungary, and the guy is shocked to see that Amital, you also survived, and you remained religious. And remember, I quote this in Washington, Rav Amital gives a fabulous answer, and tell me, if I didn't remain religious, I would understand the Holocaust, you know, as if to say, so if you're really... Anyway, I thought the guy, I implied the guy who said this to him was not from, no. And now I recall the whole episode. It goes back to a home machloket they had in Hungary where Rabbi Mital said, we have to get ready for Kiddush Hashem. We got to sanctify our lives. We're not going to survive. And this guy said, no, you're wrong. You have to do everything to survive. The guy who said you have to do everything to survive winds up in Alon Shvut, winds up in that area. And he meets Rav Amital Labriut. Remember, no one knew who survived. We're talking 43, 44. They had snuck out somehow to Israel. And I don't want to use Rav Amital's language, but he's very salty and very damn terse where this guy says to him, you maneuver. You're the guy, he says to Rav Amital. You're the maneuver who fought with me. We got to get ready to die. And you also survived. And you're also from... And Amital, that's when he gave the answer. So I make that correction. Also, when I mentioned among the Rebbe Shluchim, Yitzchak Wilhelm, and I said he must be from the Torah Vedas Williamsburg family, he's not related to that family. I thank Aryeh Lieberman for correcting me. Another bit of information from Maya Lieberman, that the person who wrote the book on the trial, Rabbi Moshe Bogomilsky, is Rabbi Shmuel Pesach Bogomilsky's older brother. Remember I told you how I was very close to Rabbi Shmuel Pesach and the rabbinate? This was his older brother. And although I have a footnote that it was originally written in Hebrew and published privately and not made available for sale, there is an English version which is available at bookstores. My Talmud, who you all know, Chaim Meiselman, or Rabbi Chaim Meiselman today, corrects me that Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik didn't live at near Yeshiva College. I want to correct your English, Chaim, not by near. He lived at 170th Street, 5th Street, near the Beis Medrash HaGadol, the Bialystok Magid Shul. The Magid was a musmach of Reb Chaim Briska. And I accept the correction. I only have to tell you that in my time, Rebbetzin Pesha Soloveitchik lived across the street from the yeshiva. That's where the Rav stayed when he came to New York. They didn't have an apartment for him. It's before they built the dormitories. And it was right opposite the yeshiva. The entrance, I believe, is on 185th Street, but their apartment, as I recall, faced Amsterdam Avenue, right opposite the yeshiva. So we're both right. It depends what we're talking about. Okay, now back to here. Today is a very fascinating shiur. I don't know if we're going to finish it all, but wow. Now, I have to tell you, Donnie, you believe everything the Rebbe says, everything Rabbi Klushkin wrote, everything I'm quoting. So you should know I uncovered last week, right here in this building, there is a Rebbe in Torah Shraga who lived next door to the Gur'aye family in New Jersey. And Rabbi Dr. Howie Apfeld, recognize the name, Danny? Okay, you know who he is, Howie Apfeld. This is, when I was growing up, everyone spoke about Rabbi Zev Gold's, was a younger brother, who was rabbi in Galveston, Texas. Rafael Gold, the famous rabbi, a great speaker, and he left the rabbinate to become a psychiatrist. He evidently reached the conclusion the best of the Balabatim are crazy, they need a psychiatrist for help, and he left the rabbinate. So today it's just the opposite. Medical doctor after medical doctor becomes a rabbi. This Howie Apfeld is a very skilled cardiologist. I don't know if he had come to me if I would tell him become a rabbi. But Baruch Hashem, he gave up a good deal of his medical practice, and he's a beloved Rebbe in Torah Shraka. Okay, now let's pick up where we left all week. You missed some very interesting insights, Yitzchak. Okay, let's pick up where we left off last week. Here we have the library. Here we have that famous letter. And suddenly they notice Sfarim are missing. And they go to the Rebbetzin. What should we do? And the Rebbetzin gives them advice to install a camera, which was something very primitive at the time. And lo and behold, they see the person taking books. May 1985, we're talking about exactly 31 years ago. They recognize the person. It is Barry Gur'aye. It is the Rebbe's nephew. It is basically the Rebbetzin's blood nephew. The son, the only child of her sister, the only one of the six Rebbe's three daughters to have a child. One sister was killed in the Holocaust, and as you know, the Rebbetzin and the Rebbe did not have any children. And they see he's the one taking the books. Now, the Rebbetzin was told immediately. They didn't have the guts to go to the Rebbe and tell him. They let the Rebbetzin do that, which you can all understand. We don't know the Rebbe's reaction, but immediately the Rebbe called in his brother-in-law, Reb Shmayaru Gur'aye, who by now had become a chassid of the Rebbe, the man that at least the majority of the family felt should have succeeded the sixth Rebbe, but the Hasidim ruled otherwise and selected Reb Menachem Mendel. The Rebbe speaks to his brother-in-law, and he wants the brother-in-law to have influence on his son, return the books. The Rebbe warned him that the next big, if you realize May, so the next big Fabrengen is Yud Bet Tammuz. Yud Bet Tammuz, if I'm not mistaken, is when the sixth Rebbe got out of Russia, got out of jail, got out of the death sentence against him. And the Rebbe warned his brother-in-law that he would speak about it at that public Fabrengen if the books were not returned. Reb Barry turned down his father and refused to return, and the Rebbe spoke in public without mentioning his name. No one except for a few individuals who were close to the Rebbe who had been involved in discovering the relocation or the loss of the books. They were the only ones who knew what the Rebbe was referring to, and the Rebbe was very clear and strong and broke into tears that something terrible has happened, and he spoke about the fact that the sixth Rebbe's life are his books, are his manuscripts, and he started to shout, the Rebbe, the books will remain my father-in-law's living legacy and his very essence to the end of time. And you will know that the seventh Rebbe, time and again for him, the sixth Rebbe was a living presence. I think that's true of all Gedolei Yisrael. Anyone who studied with the Rav, there wasn't a greater living presence in the classroom than Reb Moshe, his father, and Reb Chaim, his grandfather. And that's just true. This is what Masorah is about. Just because the sixth Rebbe is dead, but his heritage is alive, his legacy. And I don't have to tell you, the books, the library, a most valuable library, and here someone is taking them one by one. Now watch. Here are some of the details. I'm quoting, I told you, I could quote from many different Sfarim, but there's no argument here. The facts are the same. They're all feeding off Bogomilsky's work, the New York Times, and I have a little bit more to add because I'll come to it, but not yet. I just want to describe the facts before I move sideways and raise some interesting issues. And on page 388, beginning on 388, Rabbi Joseph Tushkin, it's a beautiful volume. The volumes on the Rav, the volumes on the Rebbe that his key Hasidim put out, Rabbi Miller, Rabbi Tushkin, and Rabbi Steinfeld, they are all masterpieces and they all complement each other. The one of Rabbi Eliezeri already is a fabulous volume, but that's more in Chabad in general than the Rebbe per se, although obviously the Rebbe is the focal figure. So, you see, Barry and his uncle, as what I told you last week, at one time had been very close. When Barry was 6 years old, his father and grandfather were away for an extended period. They visited Eretz Yisrael, they visited America. We're talking about 29, 30. The Rebbe actually spent, I think, like 10, 11 months in the United States. If I'm not mistaken, first they went to Eretz Yisrael, then they came here. And the Rebbe laid the groundwork for what 8, 9 years later would become a living Chabad in America. But the groundwork was laid during that visit where he visited many, many cities, Toronto, Chicago, Detroit. He knew what America was about. And that's why perhaps he was so firm that he didn't just come to retire and be an old man in America. Now, when the sixth Rebbe was in America, who accompanied him? Barry, his father, Rav Shmaya Guraye, the Rashag. So who was living in Berlin at the time? Living in Berlin was the Ramash, Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson, and his wife. They were still in Berlin. This is where he knew the Rav from. So the Gurayes took an apartment so the two sisters could be near each other when the father was in America. During that period, he was very close to the Rebbe. He remained the seventh Rebbe. And Barry himself said, at times I was closer to my uncle than my father. People recall that in America, when they finally were reunited in 1941, Barry was doing mathematics with his uncle. His uncle was teaching him mathematics, and Barry broadened as a result of the influence of his uncle, the image of his uncle, I should say. Barry broadened, and as you all know, he graduated Torah Vadas, was a Musmach Mateira Vadas, and went on to do graduate work in physics. He has papers that are published, research papers. So it's interesting that Barry ultimately shifted gears and became more like his uncle, and I would say more like his uncle wanted to be in his original dreams, as I imagine, in Berlin and Paris. His uncle never dreamt he would become Rebbe. Yeah.
Did he always stay frugal?
Oh, yeah. No. That's not only that, they couldn't have children either. You know, you say sterility is not inherited. To be sterile, sterility is not inherited. You understand? And yet here you see in the family so few children. And they adopted two. He was married to a girl, I spoke about it last year, he was married to a girl from a Chasheva Chabad, old-time family. And it was a very beautiful marriage, Barry's marriage. And they adopted two children, two daughters, okay? Those daughters went on to raise wonderful, frum families. I met again, they don't even realize their own yichus because they're totally integrated in the greater YU world, what you would call modern Orthodox. I don't like the word modern Orthodox, but they're totally integrated. But of course they're frum. And you can hear now, if you get hold of Dr. Apfeld, by the way, he's one of four brothers. One is more brilliant than the other. One brother was a serious candidate for a Nobel Prize, his research. He didn't get it, but he was a serious candidate. Who knows what will happen in the future? So he's an interesting individual. He can tell you, Barry was a fine, frum, good Jew. But, unfortunately, it seemed... Well, maybe he has a case. Relax. Don't give judgment yet, and wait till I finish all the judgment and tell you what happened, and then I'll tell you a footnote what Zvi Groner and I used to debate endlessly. But relax. Now, it seems that all this goodwill came to an end in the pivotal year following the sixth Rebbe's death, and of course you have to understand. The family, the surviving Rebbetzin, okay? The daughter, Hannah, they felt very strongly there was one person to succeed the sixth Rebbe, and that was Rav Shmaya Guraye. And as I explained to you last year, logically they were totally correct. The Rashag was, it wasn't just the son-in-law. He was the son that the sixth Rebbe didn't have. They lived next to each other. They never separated from each other. When the sixth Rebbe visited Israel and America, who went with him? And the Rashag was a Talmud Chacham. He was a Rei Shemayim. He knew Hasidus. I'll throw out a thought. Tell me, who is a bigger Talmud Chacham, the Rashag or the present Belzer Rebbe? You just think for a minute. Who is a bigger Talmud Chacham, the Rashag or the present Gera Rebbe? Chassidus is not a yeshiva. In a yeshiva, you have to have the goods to deliver. If a Rebbe doesn't have a unique method, a Kiddush, he's not going to have a world of Talmidim. You understand the Soloveitchik family, you can be Soloveitchik from today to tomorrow. You understand what I taught you last week when I told you? You can drive a car, you drive a taxi if you can't learn on a level. You have to... And you know, look what happened to Tel's Yeshiva in America. Any one of you visited the Wycliffe, am I pronouncing it right? Wycliffe, how do they pronounce it? The suburb where Tel's is? Shteyt Leidig, it's empty. I was there with Malka, we were flabbergasted. In a Beit Medrash that can hold 600-700 people, there's a wall built in, an ugly wall, and there are 20 Talmidim sitting in front of it. You want Tel's, you got to go to Chicago, you got to go to, where is it? Riverdale, I thought it was Mount Vernon, no, it's in Riverdale. There you have Tel's today, because in a Litvish yeshiva, it's family owned. And if the family doesn't produce on that level, they're not going to have Talmidim. YU has an advantage as a public trust. A public trust means anyone who has the ability to deliver rises to the top. You don't have to marry the right girl. Okay, So, but what I said a minute ago, think what I said. It's not so simple. In the Hasidic world, you need the blood. Don't have to be a big Islamdin. The Belzer Rebbe, I stand in awe of what that man built. But if someone's going to tell me he's the Gadol HaDor I'm learning, it's not so. Look at Ger. Look at the present Gary Rebbe. He does not speak in public. Can you picture Rosh Yeshiva who has a rule? He doesn't speak in public. All right? Can you picture Rakefet doesn't speak in public? Where the heck would Rakefet be today? He'd be sitting home, a retired man, watching cable TV. But a Rebbe, he doesn't speak. Oh, the Rebbe, Rednish, it's a different feeling. So don't say to me, I don't want Alex to say to me that the seventh Rebbe could learn better than the sixth Rebbe. Of course, he had a photographic memory, he was a genius of geniuses, but that doesn't make him Rebbe. The sixth, the Rashag, knew how to learn, knew Hasidus, he worshipped the ground his father-in-law walked on. He should be the Rebbe. But the Hasidim played a big role here. And this is a history, I don't have time now, but if I think I spoke about it 20 years ago when I did the history of Torah Modern Times. Look what happened to Kutz when Reb Menachem Mendel died. Hasidus broke into three. A third of it was Ger. The first Ger Rebbe, the Reb Yitzchak Meir, the Rim, was Rosh Yeshiv and Kutz. They insisted you become a Rebbe. No, look how big Ger is today. They survived the Holocaust, totally wiped out, and look how they rebuilt. So there's something to be said, Rashag. But the Hasidim opened their mouths. We spoke about this, and Rabbi Menachem Mendel becomes Rebbe. The family never accepted this. It's very sad. It was played out in public. Many of us have problems in our families. I don't think there's one person here who can say, we don't have a problem we'd like to correct. It's the nature of human beings. But it's stille hate, quiet. No one knows what's going on in your chalan pot. These are Gedolei Yisrael with hundreds of thousands of eyes looking at them. And the machloket was played out in public. For Haraya, in 1953, Barry married. He did not invite his uncle, who was then in his second year as the formal seventh Rebbe of Lubavitch, to the wedding. Now, Barry had panasa, Barry worked, the tension remained. I think I told you a year ago, it is said, no one can prove this, but it is said that the Rebbetzin Chayamashka Zichrona Tzadeket Levracha never went to public fapreinos. No, you have to ask a question. I know when the Rav gave the Yahrzeit Shir, the Rebbetzin was in the audience. When the Rav, I remember when Ben Gurion visited America, gave the talk at Yeshiva, the Rav, the first time he appeared in public after his major operation, the Rebbetzin was in the audience. When the Rav gave the chesped for Reb Velvel, the Rebbetzin was in the audience. We all know the Rebbetzin was in the audience because that's when the tremendous ruckus broke out and Rabbi Cohen of Flatbush yelled at the Rav in public and no one knew what to do. And the Rebbetzin yelled down, take him out.
Why did he yell at him?
I've lectured about that. Not only did I lecture about that, they played my lecture for Rabbi Cohn in, Rabbi David Cohn? The Gevul Yavetz. They played my lecture, and he responded to it. And it was so funny, because I said, rumor had it that Rabbi Cohn went out and called Rabbi Yitzchak Kutner to ask what to do. I said, it was a rumor. And he said, what's Rabbi Rakefet talking about? I didn't call Rabbi. Yes, but it's true. The next morning, Rabbi Gutman called me to give me a Yashikayach. So we had it was a good laugh across the world. But he's a nice guy. I hope he has the same good feeling I have for him for me. But he then was a Kanai. You don't know what went on. The Rebbetzin yelled, take him out, take him out. And, all right, let's not go further. I want to keep to today's lecture. Your question hangs fire. Go back and look it up on the YU Torah website. If you find the lecture, I'll dance the Kazatska, and you'll hear it with your own two ears. Back here. So, you see, the Rebbetzin didn't... Why didn't she come? Why didn't she come? And one theory is, and I've heard this from the real good Hasidim, that she didn't want to embarrass her sister-in-law. She always felt if she comes, the Hasidim will give her... Her sister, I should say. Hasidim would give her covered malachim, her Rebbetzin, Chayav Mashka. She'd rather listen by telephone or later by cable TV, the way they worked it out, not to embarrass Chana Gur Ayeh. All right. By the mid-1980s, evidently, Rabbi Gur Ayeh Jr., Barry, needed money. Again, it's unclear what happened. He had a job. He lost the job. Well, why did he need money suddenly? Unclear. On the other hand, there are people, I've seen this in life, when they grow older, they start asking themselves, what am I leaving my children? And people have poked me many times, people who know me well, that I'm irresponsible. I should make money, royalties, my books, my lectures, my tapes. And some of you know me well and know that I always say I'm the happiest man in the world, that people want to hear my Torah, my knowledge, etc. So they say to me, well, what about your grandchildren? So here I differ with my friends who are wealthy. Kids have to struggle. Because they struggle, they conquer the world. They succeed. And I can give you many examples. You can give many examples. It's what difference is between kids who have an annuity every morning they wake up, don't have to fight life, and a kid who has to fight? So whatever Barry's reasons were, Anidana told the Kapskut, he was worried about his grandchildren, and now you come to the tremendous question, who owns the Svarim? And here, remember, Barry is the only living descendant on that generation. Who owns the Svarim? I have a big library. Thousands of Svarim. No question, I own it. Here you're dealing with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. It's a public trust. Who paid for the Svarim? This money was donated by Chassidim. The Rebbe loved Svarim, appreciated manuscripts. You have to be on a level. Some people have no interest. Some people pay a fortune for some Talmud that was published 500 years ago. Another person will say, what, are you an idiot? I can go online and it's all there. I don't have to tell you what's online. We go to Hebrew books. Remember I told you, Yitzchak and I both have a very valuable book, Maneli Geret. It's a book against Reb Moshe Feinstein's Psak by Semi Satmar. I don't want to go into more details. They're all against many of his psakim. Many. It's me, Maneli Geret, answering the Geret Moshe. So in his introduction, he's very caustic against Reb Moshe. In America, the Yishud Acherim, no book dealer would sell the book. All right. There was an underground. It's like making of a gazel. If you're willing, I actually had two copies of the book. Two Talmidim bought it for me. So one I kept and one I gave a gift to Reb Moshe Horowitz, if I recall. Maneli Geret.
Is it a real, like, halakhic work?
Yeah. It was by a big lamdan, a tremendous Talmud Chacham. Because the language is too sharp. You had to know Reb Moshe. Reb Moshe was beloved. This is not Satmar versus Lubavitch. This is Reb Moshe who was held in awe and beloved. And this is, all right. So the book is now put on Hebrew books. So remember what I said in class? I said, Yitzchak, we just lost money. Anyone who wants it can go to Hebrew books. But there's going to be a guy, a collector, who's going to go Sotheby's, is going to have an auction. Here is Schwartz's, Rabbi Schwartz's book against Reb Moshe Feinstein. How much am I offered? A guy will put up $10,000. Wow, idiot, it's on Hebrew books. But okay, you got to be a collector. The sixth Rebbe was a collector. You understand? And his library consisted of manuscripts, ketuvim of the previous Rebbeim. It consisted of rare editions. Who needs a chumash? I can buy a chumash for $2. But this is a chumash published 600 years ago. All right, I don't have to elaborate. You understand what I'm saying? Not only that, the Rebbe had in his library books on science, books on mathematics, books on philosophy. Some of the books were filled with apikursis. But this is a library, you have to be knowledgeable. It's an open Gemara Sanhedrin that someone who has to deal with difficult childless has to know every type of Avedah Zarah in the world, right or wrong, Shibin Lashonat, and all that goes with it. So who owns these books? And I mean, this is not a simple question. You know, you can't just throw it out. Wow, who owns them? But now I want to show you, it makes the question infinitely harder, infinitely more difficult. And this is something, as I said, I had a periscope right into the Rebbe's office. Tzvi Groner, Zeicher Tzadik Levracha, was a big Talmud Chacham. He was a, you know, we grew up, we know each other. He was in BTA, he was in MTA. We know each other way, way back. We're very close, very different, but very close. And, you know, we kept on thinking, well, let's now take another Hasidus. Let's now take another Hasidus. I don't want to identify the person. My friend, my dear friend in Zivik Sheni, just married a girl that I know for the last 70 years. She was widowed, he was widowed, she was widowed many years. No, this girl, Silva, gold collector. No? Can anyone tell me what her yichus is? There's an expression in Yiddish. Her sister, we always used to, whenever we were her sister, we were intimate friends. That couple, my wife and myself, a few other couples, never, many are not alive. But we always used to say to her sister, you don't have enough jewelry on. Fa'arushuna aneinuku? Knew that anyone picked up what I said? Donnie, you know what I just said? Alex will spend your hours explaining it to you. Rushan was a dynasty. Malchut. You have any idea what we're talking about, Malchut? The Rushan Rebbe went in the carriage that six Hasidim pulled. And please don't correct me if it's eight. The corrections are important, but not about six to eight.
You say Hasidim, you mean horses.
Horses, Hasidim marched around the carriage. The horses were secondary. Covered, you went in like Malchut. The original Rebbe wore golden threads in his bekesh. No? Look, do you understand Rushan? It's not so hard to understand Rushan. I'll just tell you what I said 20, 30 years ago when I lectured on it. And no one in the world has proven me wrong. Adarabba vi adarabba. I was once asked by a girl I was teaching in Midrashet Moriah. She was in a wheelchair. No, the parents from Berkeley. And she said to me, Rebbe, why can't the Kohen of Baal Mum do the Avoda in the Beis HaMikdash? Okay, Moshe, you got a question like that from a girl in a wheelchair. How do you handle it? So I explained to her. I quoted the Gemara in Pesachim, Daf Samech Vav. Jason, you know what they did with the extra money that came into the Beis HaMikdash? People made an appeal, sent out letters to Rakefet, is coming out with a new volume, to sponsor it. It's oversubscribed. You understand? People want, what do you do with the extra money? All right, we have no problem. They already worked out with me that we'll have another volume. This will be volume 3, and volume 4 will come out within 2 years. So the extra money will go to good use. What do you do with the extra money that came into the Beis HaMikdash? What did the Gemara in Pesachim say? They built beautiful carpets of gold and hung them up new so that when the Olei Regel would come, they would look at the gold and say, She'ein bo delam. Quoting the Gemara, there is nothing missing here. This represents perfect life. When I go to the Mekdash, I want it to be perfect. No, what does a person want in life? Health, wealth, happiness, good children, the Beis HaMikdash, perfect, spiritual, wealth, gold, silver, lack for nothing. The Kohanim, healthy. We all want to be healthy. The Fana, we pray to God every day. I said, it's the ideal. I didn't want to go further and say to her, don't you want to be healthy? She got the message. She loved the answer. My dear students, we now go back 200 years in time. We're living in Poland. Ah, downtrodden. Abgeschlagen. Don't know how to translate that. Beaten up. Poor. Suffering. Worried about getting potatoes and herring for Shabbos. We go to the Rebbe. It's like a Beis HaMikdash. Malchut. Beautiful. Ein Bordelam. Nothing is missing. The Rebbe goes, my Bekisha, I should bring it in and show it to you. A black Bekisha. Ripped here, ripped there, sewn more. The Rebbe once described the Bekishes in his neighborhood in Warsaw that they had more threads sewing them than there was from the original Bekisha. And the Rebbe goes with a golden Bekisha. No, tell me, who owns the Rushina money? No, there's no question. The Rebbe's own the money. The Rebbe's, it's their money. Chassidim give it to them. They do with it what they want. A chassid travels, he goes, what do they call it, tourist class. The Rebbe goes, not just business class, first class. Who owns the money? In Ruzhin? No question, it's the Rebbe. Interesting. So when you come now to the question with Lubavitch, it's not black and white. Barry makes a case. Let me go a little bit further. It's sad to talk about this, but these are the facts. When it became a public issue, Chanuguraye spoke up. And she said that she spoke to her sister. And she said to her sister, and this becomes very important in the trial, this is the way she describes the conversation, that you and I are the only heirs of our father. What did our father leave us? A wonderful library, worth a fortune. I want half the books, and you are entitled to half the books. I don't need them, you don't need them. But Barry would like to take some. And the Rebbetzin, according to Chana, Rebbetzin Chaya Mashke said to her, quote, let him take as many as he wants, but he should do so b'li pirsum, without public knowledge. Quote, I have no heirs. I myself will not study these books. Let Barry go ahead and take as many as he wants. That's what Rebbetzin Chana will later testify as to the conversation. We'll see what the Rebbetzin answers, but not yet. The Rebbe asked rhetorically when he heard what his sister-in-law said, I quote, when does he come like a ganav in the middle of the night? If my wife gave him permission, do it. Sunlight, broad daylight. A ganav in the middle of the night? All right. The Rebbe was in conference with his top Gabayim, Rabbi Krinsky, Rabbi Shem Tov, and they decided to immediately call the most famous Orthodox Jewish lawyer in the entire Western world, I would say, until today, Nat Lewin. All right? How many of you know Nat Lewin? Nat Lewin and I, he was a year ahead of me in school, but I was a year ahead of myself in yeshiva. We were classmates. Nat Lewin has tremendous yichus. His father, Rabbi Dr. Isaac Yitzchak Lewin, was a big Talmud Chacham, a PhD, taught at Bernard Revel, represented Agudat Yisrael at the UN, principal of Central Yeshiva High School, top individual. He descends. His grandfather was Reisha Rav, Rav Aaron Lewin. Gadol Shebegadolim, one of the biggest Rabbanim in Poland. His great-grandfather was Rav Yitzchak Shmelkes, one of the greatest respondents of the first half, the Beit Yitzchak, the first half of the 20th century. Everyone quotes Rav Yitzchak Shmelkes today. Can anyone tell me in what case we're talking about when it comes to conversion? And it's Zera Beit Yisrael. It's a term that I don't know if he introduced it, but he certainly publicized it. That we have to have a different attitude if a Goy Gomer walks in, if this individual comes into this classroom and says to you rabbis, I want to convert. No, what would I do? He walks in, he wants to convert. This is, what's his name? The American rapper, Damon Black. I would throw him out and say, you want to convert? We don't need conversion. We don't need converts. Go out and observe the Sheva Mitzvah and be a good Gentile. If you come back a second time, you know, the Gemara, I'm quoting, I'm paraphrasing the Gemara in Yevamot now, Dachman Vavamot Bet, okay? Mem Zayin Amad Aleph, the whole sugya there. If he comes back a second time, then I'll be a little bit more gentle. But if someone walks in and says, my great-grandfather was Jewish, but I want to convert back to Judaism. Could be, you can't throw him out. Zera Beit Yisrael, you have to treat him differently. So Nat Lewin, what can I tell you? What a fabulous choice. It's the middle of the night, you know, that the Rebbe never slept. He's one of those people that got along on 3 hours sleep. I know many people like this. Rabbi Riskin's another example. Rav Nevensal, I know many examples like this, people who literally don't have to sleep. All right, I'm practically at that stage in life today, but that's not Meirat Soni. It's only a result of the years I've lived Kanayin Hara. So they, in the middle of the night, they call Nat Lewin and wake him up. I think it tells you here, one second, let me see what time. I think it tells you the actual time they called him. 2 a.m. They call Nat Lewin and they wake him up. So Rabbi Krinsky leaves it with him that he'll come to his office tomorrow in Washington. He'll fly out and they'll discuss what has to be done. Okay, gentlemen, you come to a very delicate question. The only ones in this room who will really, truly understand me are Jay Solomon and Yitzchak Rubin. Gentlemen, the two names I've just mentioned, do you remember a Bostonian, the late Jerry or Yaakov Fogelman? No, Yitzchak?
Yep.
Thank you. Jay, remember him well.
Can any? He's not a Bostonian. He was from Reading, Pennsylvania. When he finished Yeshiva College, he went to Harvard Law School.
Okay, excuse me, Raymond, Pennsylvania. Massachusetts.
Reading, Pennsylvania.
So how do you wind up in Brookline?
Harvard
how do you,
Law School.
Harvard Law School. Okay, because I know him.
And he used to go Saturday night to hit the road.
Right, and he was about, I believe he was about Tshuva, if I recall the stories, involved with Chafetz Chaim in New York, and he winds up. Anyway, brilliant guy, but a character par excellence. I understand he used to boast to me that the Rav said to me, Fogelman, you're like a conservative Hasidic Rebbe. That's what the Rav, because he used to bother the Rav with shilas and, you know, the usual questions to open up a little bit our world. And the Rav said to him, you're a conservative Hasidic Rebbe. Now, why did I bring Jerry Fogelman into this? Oh my, you're missing a little history. Now, let me tell you. The early 70s, a publication appeared. I have it in my office, I believe. Shayurim of the Rav. Shayurim. It was called me Beit Midrashon Shel HaRav, Mashahu Kazeh. volume appeared. I called Tova. She was hysterical. I brought the volume. I had bought it. I used to go to Meir Shearim, to Mitzna. It's a bookstore. One of the Lichtenstein boys married into that family, a very wonderful family. Which one? Could be Moshe, the Rosh Yeshiva that I wrote, Moshe Lichtenstein. So I brought the guy, Tova lived around the corner from me. She lived mamish around the corner from where I lived for a few years when they first came. So I brought it over. Oh my gosh, she was hysterical. Who put it out? Nope, take a guess. Jerry Fogelman. First publishing venture in Israel. Remember, he had property, they told me, in Brookline, real estate. So he didn't really have to work the way the rest of us work. He had Mrs. Pizer ran the property. Is my memory correct? I'm going back, you don't even know. I'm not a Bostonian, but I recall Mrs. Pizer, the mother of many of her children were my students. And she ran the property for him in absence. And she was trustworthy 100%. And they were hysterical. What did he put out? How does Jerry Fogelman? He wasn't the Gadol Hador. It was Reb Heschel Schachter. We spoke about Reb Heschel yesterday. His notes that later were circulated in a mimeograph form or circulated already in a mimeograph form, Jerry put it out. Big book, a green cover. Remember it well.
And they were upset because...
Upset?
They didn't want them published because they wanted to publish themselves.
Alex, you got to spend 40 years with Rakefet to know what the Torah and all its ramifications are about. You don't remember my lectures on the Rav's hang-up on perfectionism?
No, right, so that's what I'm asking. They didn't want them published at all.
Of course, at this point in life, all that the Rav had published was Ish Halakha philosophy, and as I said, he had to establish a rep in the early 40s, came to Yeshiva, the boys, who is this clean-shaven guy? What is he? What, when, where? Had to let the world know what he knows, a little bit of what he knows. Okay? But philosophy is, you know, you can't get lost. You're a philosopher. There's this viewpoint. It's not like Reb Chaim that you have to get, this is truth, everything else is wrong. Philosophy, you don't talk like that. Different approaches. Then a Litva, come from a kind of
Russian. You could argue that.
But say that, don't argue now, but just enjoy the Rebbe's comment. But that's why he published. No one, by the way, and anyone hears this who knew the Rebbe, they left. They say, you know, you're right. You're right. So, they were furious. They called the Rav in Boston. And Tova told me, quote, I remember word by word what she told me. The Rav said, go to court immediately and get an order that the books cannot be sold, and then you'll go to court you'll go to Beis Din. But go to court immediately to stop the distribution of the money. That's what they did. They got a show cause order, whatever they call it. There must be any lawyer sitting here. Must be a technical term that Fogelman has no permission and no right to sell these books.
Do they really have a case? A student can't publish notes from his class?
With
a disclaimer that these
right,
notes...
Right, but these notes were as if the Rav had given his okay, was publishing it himself. Now, notice, why am I telling you all this? Gentlemen, this is exactly what happened with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Watch. His Hasidim, leading Hasidim, the inner circle, meet with Professor Lewin, Dr. Lewin, Nat Lewin. Nat Lewin says, what are you, crazy to go to court? Zichel Hashem. I have to tell you, you have to go to Beis Din. Rabbi Krinsky came prepared. The Rebbe gave him a whole list of sources when you're allowed to go to a secular court. It is exactly the thinking of the Rav in the early 70s. You know why? Sure, you have to go to Beis Din. But based in cannot stop the distribution of books. They do not have that authority. The only one who, it's a democracy. Who can stop you? There's no trial yet. No one has been found guilty. No one has been penalized. There's no court decision. Beitin does not have that power. A secular court can immediately, it's put in escrow. It's put in a bonded vault. No one has access, not to the books, not to the money, whatever the debate is about. Then you can go to Beitin and fight it out. But here they wanted to be sure that Barry would not sell any more books. Nat Lewin, and this is a very, so that's the analogy exactly the Rebbe's thinking and the Rebbe's thinking in a similar issue. And Tova went to secular court. They got a show cause order, a restraint. Those volumes became valuable because only a few people were smart enough to buy them when they first came out. It's like the day I daven mincha in the Shtiblach in the Shuk, I met Nathan Kamenetsky, Natan Kamenetsky, Nassim Kamenetsky, as he calls himself, and he was all excited. He showed me the first copy of Making of a Gadol, Volume 1 and Volume 2 had just come out that day. 3 days later, I was in Hanof. I went into a book dealer. Do you? Oh, yeah, I just got it in. I bought the two books for pennies, the original edition. Need not tell you what they're worth today. Later, when I defended him and wrote a big article in Jewish Action, so the improved edition, he gave me a gift already. But Baruch Hashem, I have it. Secular court locked it up. Now, what do you do further? So in conversation with the Shluchei Chabad, Nat Lewin finds out that Barry Guraye lives in Montclair, New Jersey. Tell me, does that say something to you? Has your legal mind picked it up? Where were the books robbed from? Brooklyn, 770 Eastern Parkway. They were taken from one state to another state. What has it turned it into? A federal crime. The minute it's a federal crime, it has to go to federal court. Nat Lewin said, that is fabulous. And here's something I've always suspected, but I never heard anyone say this as clearly. I'm quoting Nat Lewin. I personally have much more confidence in federal courts than I do in state courts. And they generally have better judges. Gentlemen, when it comes to state courts, some of them are elected. It's not what you know, it's who you know. There's political input. There's pressure. Federal courts, to become a federal judge, you need stature. Because there's no local political pressure. It's not that people are voting you in or that everyone is watching you. A federal court, of course, there is some political input on the nomination and the appointment, as you all know, but you can't come up with a Johnny-come-lately and push him in to be a judge. So Nat Lewin was much happier it now goes to federal court. Immediately, the court issued the restraining order. That's the word they use. Barry was not allowed to sell any more books, and the whatever books he still had in his house were simply put into a bonded vault until the trial would be over. The judge that handled it, the federal judge, who happened to be Jewish, immediately said to them, look, this is a case that will create Chilul Hashem, bad reputation for Judaism, for people in black, for people with beards. You must go to a Beit Din beyond my restraining order. They tried to get Barry Gurayeh to agree, but he refused. Obviously, I think you can understand why. My daughter, I visited South Africa. I feel bad. They invited me back, but I just can't come back at that time of the year. I'll be in America, and then I'll come back from America. Then I want to start teaching. But they're very fine people in South Africa. And I'd love to go back one time when I can work it out, when it's good for them and good for yours truly. I was in South Africa. A woman came over to me, and she blessed me and told me about my daughter. And the minute someone tells me, someone came over to me in shul this week again, blessing me. I said, don't bless me, bless my wife for raising such a daughter. Okay. So I know right away it's problems in the Beis Din, divorce. Well, this woman told us a story. She was married into a very prominent rabbinic family. Leman Kvot Hashem, I don't want to mention the name. Her husband threw her down a flight of steps. It was obviously a marriage where a nice-looking woman, fine, but money from South Africa, and he was from the Geula area. And I don't know what went wrong, or maybe the guy was a maneuver to begin with, a very self-centered individual who thought he can own his wife, push around his wife, throw her down a flight of steps. When she went to my daughter, the divorce process started. My daughter told her this is going to be very, very difficult, because every Dayan will hear the name of your husband's family, and it's going to be hard for them to see the truth. And she said, your daughter called the shots perfectly. Gentlemen, I can understand Barry Gurayeh. He's going to go to Beis Din. Now, who are you suing? What's involved here? Barry Gurayeh versus Reb Menachem Mendel Schneerson, the Lubavitcher Rebbe. So we have to understand him. He refused. Well, if he refuses, now you all know the halacha. Then you're permitted. Eila mishpat mashet tasim lifneihem. Lifneim v'lo lifnei ha'akum, you can't go to a civil court. But if the party refuses on Choshen Mishpat area, then you get a ktav from the Beis Din, which permits you to go to the federal court. You all know this is Maisim B'chal Yom in the State of Israel. Although I have to tell you, but they didn't hear for Mishpat, for Dinei Mamonot. They have a lot of people who even aren't religious. They say the Eidah Haredit even gets Arabs because they have a very good reputation for fairness. You go into a general court, it can drag on, and testimony and witnesses and theories, and a Beit Din hears, listens, understands, makes a decision. And I've heard tremendous compliments on the but they didn't for Dinei Mamonot. I myself sat in America in the 60s with Rabbi Teitz and Rabbi Zuba. We sat on but they didn't for Mamonot. And I have to say, Rabbi Teitz, I mean, I was learning, he was terrific. He would look at the people arguing. He says, do you want in Torah the strict letter of the law where there'll be enmity between you? Or do you want the rabbis to work out a reasonable compromise? None of you will be totally happy, but neither will you be totally sad. Any moron, unless you're an absolute moron, you're going to choose the latter, not the former. And within one session, two sessions, we worked out a nice compromise. And you look into Kosher Mishpat. It's based upon the Gemara in Sanhedrin, the Fabba Mitmat, the Simon Ahmed Aleph, it's a whole sugya. But you'll see Kosher Mishpat. This is the way to run a based on a Dini Mamonot. But here I can, Barry Gurayeh, that he felt in a Beit Din, he doesn't have a chance. Now, what's fascinating is, federal courts, how do they pick a judge? It's exactly the way they work in the but they didn't hear. It's a lottery. This court, that kveis, I don't know, I got to ask my daughter how they actually do the lottery. But it could be they work. I know at one time, if your last name begins Aleph to Dalet, it's this spaced in this herkev. Hey to Chet. The same thing in the federal court system in America. It's a lottery. One judge. The judge that the lottery selected was Judge Charles Sifton. The case was called Agudas Chasidei Chabad versus Gur Aryeh. And who is the judge? Why is this name so important? This individual, Charles Sifton, he at one time, the details are in here, but I don't want to waste time finding it. His first wife was the daughter of the Protestant theologian Niebuhr. Recognize the name? The Rav many times quotes Professor Niebuhr in his writings. I believe he's quoted in Ish Halacha, he's quoted elsewhere. He was a man that the Rav had tremendous respect for. This judge had been married to his daughter. So the judge said, maybe he has to, I think the word they use is recuse himself. Am I using the right word? And he would have to take himself out of the trial if there was any objection, because he has a religious background. He's the son-in-law of, I've been the son-in-law of this great Protestant theologian. Maybe they feel it would influence his thinking. But both sides agree there's nothing wrong with his being the son-in-law, and they have the Din Torah, as we can call it, or the Mishpat, before this judge. Now, the key factor in this entire trial, one of the key factors, that this is a very delicate question. I don't want you, it's not so simple. I had many an argument with Zvi Grona. Who owns the documents? Who owns the svarim? Who owns it? I mean, it's a serious question. No one in his right mind will say the Ruzhina dynasty is owned by Ruzhina Chassidim. I'm sorry. If a great-great-great-grandson of the original Ruzhin Rebbe Yisrael Friedman has this Kiddush cup, that Kiddush cup today is worth at auction $100,000 minimum, perhaps more. It's unbelievable. A Ruzhin, a chassid who has money, what he wouldn't give it.
They're broken off. They don't have like a continued...
No, but say that they've broken to many dynasties. But you had the Sadigeri. There's a Sadigeri Rebbe. Who owns the Kiddush cup? Of course it's owned by the Rebbe's family.
But what if they wanted to sell it just private to a private collector?
They can do whatever they want. No one in the world can interfere. I don't think there's the slightest shaila. They can sell it at auction for $10 million and build the Ruzhina Shtibl wherever they want. Fine. There's a big fight going on right now. Who owns the Ruzhina Shtibl, the big Shtibl where the Vianna Rebbe Davins as an Enochel in Geula? Big fight going on. The murder that took place. Lo Aleinu, that one of the early murders where three people were killed in this present war we're fighting was exactly a half block from the Ruzhin Shtibl, right on Rehov Malcha Yisrael. But here it's a very delicate question. Who owns the library? Who has the right? Now, Moshe, go ahead. I haven't said a word yet.
Doesn't the Rebbe, as the Rebbe, have the rights to that library as his wife is?
We'll see what some of the testimony is. We'll see. React. So, yeah, Yitzchak, what do you have to say?
At Yeshiva University, there was a Professor Alex Whitman.
Of course.
And he wanted to make a point about ownership.
Right.
And so he gave the example, in a public park, right, everybody owns the flowers, but no one dares put the flower.
Okay.
So you own it? In
theory, you have a share.
But in reality, no. So the Zelmazach, you could say, okay, but the Rebbe is the one who owns, has it.
Now you're trying to say that it's available. Well, let's see the testimony, because you'll see the testimony shop. Okay, the key document that became one of the cornerstones of Lubavitch, and you'll see what the Gurayeh family had to say. The key document was the letter to Professor Alexander Marx. Now, I want to read that document to you again. It becomes critical, as you'll see, in both the judge and the appeal judge, becomes the critical document. Letter written in 1946 to the renowned scholar Dr. Alexander Marx, greetings and blessings. And he writes about what he left behind in Poland. The Nazis took it away. It's now back in the hands of the Polish government. The manuscripts are registered under the names of the rabbis, members of Agudat Hasidei, I should say Agudas Hasidei Chabad, Rabbi Israel Jacobson, and his son-in-law, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Hecht, both American citizens who are the official owners of the property. Books, several thousand books, many of them ancient books of great value, very rare. These books are the property of Agudas Hasidei Chabad of American Canada. And they're turning to Professor Alexander Marx to use your influence that the State Department should work energetically to locate these manuscripts and books in order to return them to their owners. The State Department should understand that these manuscripts and books are a great religious treasure, a possession of the nation, which has historical and scientific value. Therefore, I turn to you with a great request that you, as a renowned authority on the subject, should please write a letter to the State Department to testify on the great value of these manuscripts and books for the Jewish people in general, and particularly for the Jewish community of the United States, to whom this great possession belongs. Gentlemen, what do you think? What does that letter say? No? Prima facie? You're going to tell me there's no question. It belongs to the Kehila. It belongs to Agudas Anshei Chabad. What's the question? The letter says it black and white. No? Can we go a drop deeper? I need a favor. I don't know. I need a favor from the Prime Minister, whatever the favor is. I'm going to write to the Prime Minister. Dear Mr. Tanyahu, peace and greetings, with deep respect and love and appreciation of your difficulties that you have as the head of the Jewish people at this time, I have a small request to make of you, and I write to him what I want, and I sign it. Aaron Rakefet. Charlie? I might get an answer. I think protocol requires they write. Dear Mr. Rakefet, we were happy to receive your answer. Go fly your kite. Sincerely, we're very busy. Can't accommodate. Who the heck is Aaron Rakefet? Johnny come lately. So what? He said, how many? We're living in Israel. We're both in. I'm here 47 years. And what are you here? 44 years. Right or wrong? No. We're both considered Olim Chadashim. We weren't born here. We weren't here on the Mayflower. We don't speak Hebrew without an English accent. Our Hebrew is fluent, I agree. But still, you know, I speak three languages fluently, all with a Bronx accent. English, Yiddish, and Hebrew. But I'm a Bronxite. You know that. I just looked at the Yankee website this morning. By the way, Rabbi Schiller, there's a whole thing on the website's beautiful talk on baseball and then how you remain a Bay. It's what I say. It's part of your tribal inheritance. It's the Yankees. I grew up in the Bronx. That I got to look at them today, Kenman Plotson, that's a different story. You can faint what became of baseball. Gentlemen, now I write another letter. Yeshiva University in Israel. Dear Mr. Prime Minister, I am your humble admirer. I have a request to make. I know you don't know me, but please check with your big advisor, Eli Groner, the Prime Minister's prime advisor today. Ask him who Rabbi Dr. Professor Aaron Rakefet is. He knows me. He knows some of my scholarship, some of my work. I've authored so many books. I've taught so many students. I worked for the Mossad. I did this. I did that. Signed with all the titles imaginable. Professor of Rabbinic Literature. Gris Kollel Institute Graduate School of Yeshiva University. Get the difference in nuance between the two letters? This letter that the Rebbe wrote, the sixth Rebbe, you can take the point of view, and this is exactly what Barry Gurari's letter doesn't mean. It belongs to the Hasidim. The Rebbe understood he's a greenhorn. He wasn't even an American citizen yet. What are we talking about? The early, he wasn't an American citizen yet. Who heard his name in Washington? State Department, filled with anti-Semites. Ah, but when Professor Alexander Marx writes, Jewish Theological Seminary, Broadway and 122nd Street, even Yomo in the Ukraine heard about JTS then. Oh, Schechters. Not only that, if it's an individual Jew, look, I have some cartons of books in Poland that are worth $1 million for the Jewish people. You're an individual. No big deal. The State Department's going to act to help a little individual greenhorn, a Johnny-come-lately who just arrived in America? But no. It's owned by Akudas Hasidei Chabad. We have thousands of members, hundreds of rabbis. We are an organization. Hitler, what we went through, millions killed, at least these books and manuscripts survived. Help us out. No? Mipnei Dakei Shalom, can you tell a white lie? Yitzhak, you read me?
Yeah, but I think there's two messages in the letter. One is it belongs to Agudat Anshei.
Right.
And then he mentions the name of two American rabbis.
Who are the heads? No, they're the trustees of the Agudat.
They're not the owners of the
book. No, 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 the trustees.
Read again where they're mentioned.
They're the trustees, obviously. He doesn't say they own the Kasper company. A second. Here they are. These manuscripts are registered under the names of the rabbis, members of Agudas Hasidei Chabad. You understand, they are the representatives of Agudas Hasidei Chabad. Rabbi Israel Jacobson and his son-in-law, Rav Shlomo Zalman Hecht. I believe Rabbi Israel Jacobson, I mean, these are legendary Chabad figures. But you see, what appears to be open and shut case, not so simple. And then beneath the surface, and you'll see, I'll give you more details next week. And by the way, this is not the only evidence, there's testimony, there are comments, there are depositions, and then you'll see the sad result. But not an open and shut case. But then there's another side to the coin. And I'm going to end off with this, and I apologize for saying it, but I have to be totally honest. You see, could be you'll take the point of view, and I have to tell you, both judges, two Gentiles, took this point of view. A great spiritual leader, like the Lubavitcher Rebbe, wouldn't be totally truthful? He writes in the letter, it belongs to a good Anshei Chabad, whatever the title is. It's not mine personally. The Rebbe writes this. Would he falsify something? Now I want to ask you, how do we approach this? Look what we're living through today. A chief rabbi of the state of Israel is going to be teaching Torah very shortly in a penitentiary. Alat Mata Kodesh. Look at the machloket going on between Shari Chesed and Bnei Brak. I can't quote what so-called great rabbis are saying about other great rabbis. Hurts me to quote it. An interesting question. Could it be that a Gentile judge has more respect for Rabbanim than those of us sitting here who see all the machloket that goes on? That's a very serious question. I end off b'didi havayufta. I was guest of the community in London. Wonderful community. Very important person wanted to see me. And my time is limited. I was giving a lecture every day. So I asked my host, rabbi, the people hosting me, the balabha, oh, go see this man. He's very important. He's in the semi-Haredi community. But this man met with me. All right. Baruch Hashem, I have students all over. We spent a good day together. And he cried to me. He said, you have truth. I'm in a world that's false. I said, what are you talking about? He said, we try to portray Torah, Gedolei Yisrael, Das Torah. He says, we know the inner fights that go on, the insults, the Yagman's nefesh. He was telling me about what his father suffers, his uncle. These are well-known people. So I said to him, so why don't you join my world? He said, how can I? My wife's family, my family. P.S. 2 years later, he totally joined my world. Doesn't make me happy, but not in Israel. He couldn't come here because there'd be too much opposition. He knew exactly where to go. Very successful where he is. But he's in a different world than the world that he grew up in. But I'll never forget his words. We're in a world of falseness. And he spoke, we try to attract Balai Tshuva. We tell them, you join a Torah world. It's perfect. It's beautiful. Look at all the machloket. And I write about this in Washington. Remember that last chapter where I expressed an opinion? Read it again. I say, I grew up in a world where there was always machloikis. I went to YU, the Rosh Yeshiva from different yeshivas, hated each other with a passion. What went on? Rabbi Atelza once tried to hire Rabbi Riskin. See if he remembers, if you meet the Stevie Wonder, see if he remembers that the Rebbe tried to hire him to spy on a different Rebbe. A briska Rabbi. But I grew up with it. Not offended by it, just the opposite. It gave me the encouragement to look into one simple topic. Why do Torah Jews fight with each other so much? All right. Given many lectures on it. But you tell about Tshuva, wonderful world. We're lying to them. And Balei Tshuva hurt by this. Thousands of times I've been asked by Balei Tshuva, why do you have all this machlokes? Read Washington again, that last chapter. Okay. Would a Rebbe lie? All right, think about it. I'm not answering. We'll see what goes on in the trial, and the results are very sad. I have to say, Chabad could not, if I could hide all this, I would hide it, but Chabad couldn't. It was mamish fought out in public, in the open.
Well, one second. Necessary to do that.
Yeah, I understand. You wouldn't have gotten the books back. There was no way to hide it. I agree with you. Moria. Yeah.
All this hadn't happened. Would he have been in line to be the eighth Rebbe?
And I don't think so. You see, you're asking a good question. The question is even sharper. Why did they pick Reb Menachem Mendel? Had they picked the Rashag, Reb Menachem Mendel would have been a co-chassid of the Rebbe. It would have gone smoothly, and there would have been continuity. Or then again, with Barry, there were no sons. The daughters are adopted, all right? Maybe they were grandchildren. They would have been close to the court, even if they're adopted. There are already examples. For instance, Shapira, what was he called? The Rebbe, in his son, and his successor was really his adopted stepson after the war. Rebbe Yitzchak, the Blujina Rebbe. It's all written up in HaSefer. She did a PhD. Yafa Elyach. She did a magnificent, she should be well. She's not well today. Also, I understand Alzheimer's. It's Rabbi Michael Rosenzweig's mother-in-law. Her daughter is my student, the brilliant Professor Smadar Eliach. That's who we're talking about, her mother. So it's all written up there. Okay, gentlemen, to summarize, it's something to think about. I have to tell you, it's not, Tzvi and I used to argue on this night by night. We would follow because we had a direct in. One of the expert lawyers brought into America was our classmate, Stanley Schimmel, who was the first person that I knew of who graduated YU, I believe, in 58 or 57, and from the graduation went to the plane to go in Aliyah. And Stanley Schimmel, known to you as Professor Shmuel Shiloh of Hebrew University, also on in years, is not that well, but a brilliant, wonderful Ben Torah individual, Talmud Chacham, Mishpat Ivri was his specialty. So he was brought in as expert testimony to the United States. So it was not only Tzvi and yours truly, but we call him Shmu. Tzvi was very close to him, Shmu, Stan, because they grew up in Brooklyn, they were in the same neighborhood. Tzvi was a year younger, or 2 years younger. So Shmuel Shiloh, he was invited to testify. By the way, his son, a very successful lawyer, if you recall, a number of years ago, appearing for the Supreme Court, started to choke on his tongue, and you can die that way. And one of the Supreme Court judges here ran off the bench and saved his life, knew exactly what to do. It was headlines in every paper here. That Shiloh is Stanley and Shmuel Shiloh's son. My dear students, first of all, I thank you for your rapt attention. But it is an interesting topic. It's like a novel. It just hurts because you'll see the end results. It tears at the heart. But unfortunately, people remain people. I've learned that in life. I've learned that in life very, very sadly. I've walked into people sitting shiva recently in two separate rooms. The son is in one room, the daughter in another room, and no one is talking to each other. It's sad. It's sad. But that's life. And I realize now I have to make my peace with it. And Rabbi Rubin and I can thank the good Lord that we had the schut to sit with the Mashkiach, Rabbi Yaakov Moshe HaKohen Lessen, and be his Talmidim. And we learn different values in life. We live in a different world. I have to be honest with you, we're not in the world that most people are. Yes, Yitzchak.
When I teach converts, right, I agree to them that the ideal world is not the world that he's going to enter. And yet I say, this is how it teaches what the ideal is.
Right.
And you have to live by your own norms, not what the fear pressure.
Right. And this is what I've been trying to tell Yomo for 2 years now. We have to live in a real world, and we have to make the best of it. Baruch Hashem, to be Rebbeinu Shloimeh is not going to fault you or me for not being Rabbi Soloveitchik. But if you're not the best Aaron Rakefet can be, or Shlomo, Yomo, Yosef Mordechai can be, that is the fault line. So you see this, but this document, look how I explained it. Look how I brought in Fogelman, why they had to go to a general court. And it's amazing how history repeats itself. Okay, now before we end off with all the freebies, number one, I want to wish everyone a happy Purim. A Freilichem Purim, Simchas Purim. Number two, if anyone here gets drunk, you're a Rosh Marusha. You should be medaktek in the mitzvah of Ahavat Chinam and Ahavat Yisrael and Ahavat Abriyot. And when it comes to getting drunk, do what the Ramah says, what Rabbi Soloveitchik did, what Aaron Rakefet does, and everyone else I know. I drink a drop of schnapps. I never drink all week. On Purim, I drink out of the ordinary. I take a nap. Believe me, I don't know the difference between Haman and Mordechai when I'm asleep. And that's the way to do it. By the way, if you go to the TV today, not that it's on the websites, in Bnei Brak, they pulled off the Purim joke of the century. They announced loudspeakers went through the community, I think it was yesterday or 2 days ago, and these are the loudspeakers that always announce there's a funeral, someone died, the funeral's beginning from the year here, the yeshiva, Vishnas, whatnot. The loudspeakers went, they are now digging for oil, and they believe they have discovered oil, and B'nai Brak will become a multi-millionaire city, and they fenced up, they had Chinese workers who import, they hired them to put an all around, and they wearing equipment that you wear when you dig, like in Beverly Hills, if you recall, right there in Beverly Hills, they're big oil rigs. And the only thing is they forgot to tell the mayor. The mayor was getting in, or the police department. You see the police chief there comes in. All right, he was ready to arrest the mayor, but he understood it's a firm joke. But you tell the mayor, because people were conglomerating. There was interrupting traffic. And boy, that was a Purim skit that only in Israel could you pull it off. And it's a compliment to our people with all the Hanukkah, with everything going on. Thank God. We're able to have a sense of humor yet. Halacha l'maisa, I want to tell you a little story that happened to me. A classmate of mine who I have no contact with, he was so close, he lived a block away from me on Washington Avenue. His name, anyone from Boston will recognize the name, Shaya Balin. Shaya Balin, very brilliant guy. Parents were European, but a very brilliant guy. He was once writing notes on his Gemara, and the Rav says to him, Balin, what are you, the Vilna Gaon? And Balin says, you know, Efshek Hensayn could be. He was a chutzpahnik. Anyway, Stern College began, and girls came in from all over. And a girl comes in from Boston, all of 18, 19. And what do you know, they're getting married. There was a meeting at Stern College. The parents were furious. These girls come in from out of town, meet the big New Yorkers who know so much. And fourth, they were worried that the girls are getting married too young. Could you imagine? And they had a whole thing. Girls shouldn't go out till they're juniors and chaperone, and people should supervise. Oh, what went on? Anyway, they got married, and they've been married ever since, so it must have worked out. Now, his wedding was on Shushan Purim night, the Mopsoi Purim. So we hear little Lonnie Rothkopf is going up to Boston for the first time. We're going by train, a whole group of us. And I go over to Rebbe. Rebbe, what do I do about Purim Suda? We're going to leave New Penn Station at 12 noon, and we'll arrive in Boston, and it'll already be time for the chuppah. He said, what's the problem? I eat my Purim Suda every year at 11 o'clock in the morning. So, I was so happy. The Rav said I can make Purim Suda at 11. I want you to know, gentlemen, when I grew old and learned a little bit, the Vilna Gaon made his Purim Suda at 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning for one simple reason. The whole heter to be a little high and drink a drop of schnapps and be mevatel from Tyrus only on Purim. He wanted to be totally sober when he said Vahu Rachum Marav and drank back to learning full time with no smile on his lips. Purim was over. So you should know, you can all be Yotzei Purim Suda at 10 o'clock in the morning, 9 o'clock in the morning, 8 o'clock in the morning. You don't have to pull shtick here. The Hasidim, they love to drink, to be happy. So they start the Purim Suda 4 o'clock in the afternoon, continue into Shabbos, like the Gemara and Havei Pesachim. They put a mapar on the table, they make Kiddush, and continue all over again with Lechem Mishnah. But those of you who want to be good litvakim, and you can be yotzei Purim Suda, it has to be special food, good food. So it doesn't necessarily, if you don't like meat that much, you can be yotzei with bagels and lox too. But that depends on you. Okay.
You're not just trying to be yotzei the Purim Suda.
No, I accept.
The Stolner Rebbe is starting Shabbos at 6:30, and Purim is starting at 8:30 in the morning.
And I would love to see Yomo there on time, davening with the Rebbe like a mensch, and then the Purim Suda. Gentlemen, this is very beautiful. Mayanatecha, I tell you, Chabad, what they put out. What's unique about this, it's the latest one. There are three descriptions of Purim at the fifth Rebbe, the sixth Rebbe, and the seventh Rebbe by eyewitness participants. This is those of you that watch Israeli, the Kathmandu series. Here's an unbelievable article that was headlines in every Israeli newspaper, how the Shaluach of Chabad in Kathmandu saved the lives of two girls who were lost and freezing and whatnot, and he went on a helicopter, and how he found them. Kol HaKavod. Here's a beautiful article on the Erloi Rebbe, by our dear friend. He was once here in Shear, spoke about, his wife spoke to the class, what was it, a year or two ago, about Rav David Lifshitz. This is by Professor Chaim Waxman, who was a neighbor of the early Rebbe. Here's a beautiful description of the sixth Rebbe coming to America, and what I've spoken about so many times, America is nicht anders, that America is not any different. This is unbelievable. Last summer in Kew Gardens Hills, my wife and I see two stores with big signs in the window, Shabbos Goy available, Shabbat Shalom. Here's an article on these two individuals, what may be America's proudest Shabbos Goyes. It should be Goyim, but there it's Goyes. Here you are in Yonah Diyoma, next step for women at the war. Let me tell you, this is a problem that is not going to be solved so easily, because the Haredim have made up their mind, which I can understand. You hurried me al Yava, and can you imagine the pressure on Netanyahu? Probably couldn't care less. Let the Haredim have their way, but imagine in America, we will not give a penny to Israel. What will go on? Wow. This is an article sent to me by Jay Solomon that's very, very important. I live this, I remember it. It's when Eidah held a big conference here. It's 1999. And I remember I went to Tova. I was hysterical. And they blamed everything they do. They gave credit to the Rav. And this is Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, who by far was not a Kanoi. When you see next week's class, what the Rav said, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein could never say. They're different personalities. But here's Rav Aaron comes out against Ada very, very strongly. Here's the very important article I quoted yesterday. The new organization organized Porat, People of Orthodox Renaissance and Torah. Read about it. I dealt with it in class yesterday. Here are two things I tried to give out yesterday, but when it's written in Hebrew, unfortunately, the Art Scroll generation are Amei Haaretz in their ability to read Hebrew. Here's from Yisrael Hayom, a new outreach person. This is a Yemenite who grew up in the Mizrahi world, and now he's in the Haredi world, but open. It's a fascinating article on how he tells jokes and how he's Makarev. And finally, our dear friend that I would love to meet in person and bring him into the class, Demian Black. This is from the Yukon of a week ago, a beautiful article, and his wife. And I got to end off the class and tell you, the Afro-Americans can become the greatest Jews. When I was in Las Vegas, the shul that hosted me, so the rabbi there, Shabbos, 50 people are reading at his table, and Afro-Americans are sitting there. Some were already Jewish, some in the process of conversion. Women, they have real belief. It's a pleasure to talk with them. God is a living reality. We're living in a world where God doesn't exist. Just the human being. We're the boss. We desire. A pleasure. Read about his life. What people. We should welcome them with open arms. Breslev Hasidim, Kol HaKavod. Until we meet again in health and happiness. Das Vedanya. Yeah, he became a Breslev. Yeah, that's it. Got to read the article. Yitzchak, a little bit more open-mindedness. Nishta Noivei. I've met Breslova that are fabulous. And, you know, and if they're dancing in the street, would you object to that? Rebani Shalom.
Let them go work.
It's good. They work. The Breslova work. Please.
Those ones who were dancing in the street are like a handful of addicts.
Yeah, but I got to tell you, when I see them dancing, I laugh. If a Jew laughs, what do you want? What do you want?
You're saying, I don't think people should make
judgments
about Breslov based on
that. Yeah, no, but you hear people criticize the dancing at the Ramzar. So what? Beautiful. You are. There's a lot more to do here. You'll see the...
But
Back to this question about it, this very great, I mean, he's a descendant of the sixth, the only living descendant of anybody.
The sixth Rebbe, right.
It would have seemed to me he would have been in the natural to be the next Rebbe.
But he moved out as a circle, though. He wasn't really part of it.
You don't think, Rebbe doesn't think it would have been? I mean, forget that this wiped it out, of course.
No, I do think that, no, listen to me, Alex, for 1 second. If his father had become Rebbe,
then for sure.
Then there's a good chance he would have been the eighth Rebbe. Of course, there would have been a whole development there.
Uh-huh.
In other words, the seventh Rebbe was not the Rebbe in 1951. He developed. It's like the Rav coming to YU. You remember what I told you? They used to call the Rav in YU.
JB. I remember.
I went to Lakewood, JB. By the 50s, if a guy would have called the Rav J.B. and Wine, he would have pulled his tongue out. So you develop. Do you think I knew how to teach when I started teaching in 1959? But if a person had, you develop. It could very well be the Rashag would have become the Rashag, and Barry would have remained within the, and would have realized his Achrayah.
Mm-hmm.
But history didn't will it that way.
Mm-hmm.
The world... Totally.
It's very interesting. The Rebbe mentioned about the Ger Rebbe, you know, not necessarily the biggest or whatever, but this is the Pnei, I told
Pnei Menachem.
Menachem's youngest son.
Right.
He's a big Talmud Chacham. I think that's all he does.
No, the Pnei Menachem was also a big, was Rosh Hashiva of Svat Emet, but Reb Simcha Bunim was a businessman. The present Rebbe, I don't know what the story is, but what's very sad is, the Pnei Menachem, I believe it was Simcha, but one of them had a son who was the Gadol Shebe Gedoylo. He married the Menashe Kleinstorer. He was killed by a bus and a old Malchay. No, he would have been the next Rebbe. They were hands down.
I finished it. Sure.
Could you imagine a Rebbe who doesn't speak in Tavla? Unbelievable.